You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist. This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives.
I'm not going to lie to you.
Why are you laughing at me?
I was low-key like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it through this intro. Like, because of the way our last episode ended, I was like, I'm so paranoid that I'm
that you're gonna fuck it up
the wrong thing. Yeah. I'm just like, what?
So depending on how much of the mini episode Keegan decides to keep in at the end.
I'm leaving most of it in.
Keegan's brain left us for a moment. She's left the building, everybody.
she's so tired, my brain.
She's still real cute, though.
Thanks so much. My brain, seriously, is just like,
It's the Thursday night problem. No. I swear, if we recorded on like a Saturday at like noon.
Yeah, during the day.
You'd be getting whole other hosts. You might not like the show as much. I don't know. Maybe we're angrier at night.
Well, that's probably good.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. True, like, maybe the show wouldn't be as good if we were, like, content and awake.
Yeah.
And not
tired.
You're right.
Let us know what you think. At this point, being tired is part of the shtick, I think.
It's part of our appeal, is it not? If we didn't start the show talking about how tired we were, would we be Keegan and Madigan?
911, they'd be like, something is wrong for sure over there. That's not right. Well. I wanted to do this episode because I think that we had mentioned, or I know actually for a fact, I don't know why I do that where I'm like, I think, I know that whenever we recorded the Roe v. Wade episode, we talked about Hawaii because Hawaii was pretty unique in that it had, you know, abortion rights kind of written in for a long time and actually on and off thought for abortion rights in ways that other states did not do. And that I mentioned that that was partially because of their ancestry and their history, and that we should talk about the annexation of Hawaii.
Yes.
At some point.
I'm so glad we did too, because I think I missed this day in school.
It definitely wasn't covered. And I decided that I made a promise that I felt like I needed to keep, because somebody, and please, if it was you and you're listening, reach back out. But somebody reached out to me and said, hey, I listened to your episode. You mentioned talking about this. Are you serious about talking about it?
Because we're serious.
Oh, we're real serious. but are you serious about talking about it? Because it's something that I do think really needs to be covered. And I said, yes, of course, we'll talk about it. So I wanted to make sure that we fulfilled that promise to that person.
So here we are, fulfilling promises. We're like Make-A-Wish.
Yeah.
Except for you're not sick and dying. Oh, that just got real dark. Anyways, let's talk about the annexation of Hawaii. Like I said, had very little idea about any of the specifics of this. I feel like most of the knowledge I have about Hawaii in general is from, like, and this is horrible, but like the media and
Lilo and Stitch.
Well, more than that, I know more than Lilo and Stitch, thankfully. By the way, I had a really good Stitch impression years ago. I haven't done it in a long time, so I'm not going to do it on the podcast, but like I had a spot on Stitch impression as a kid. It was really good. But anyways, I feel like, you know what other Disney movie though? It was the Johnny Tsunami.
Okay.
That one taught me more about Hawaii because they talked more about like losing the culture and like all of that kind of stuff. So I feel like in my head, I've always been very aware of, you know, the fact that it was the last state to be added to the United States.
Yeah.
And that they've always been something very like special and different that I've seen white people try to change for years and years, especially with, you know, resorts.
Or try to appropriate.
Appropriate. Yeah. Like it's just, it's become more of like, I feel like a vacation destination and less about the authenticity of a incredibly rich culture that goes back.
Right. I mean,
since before Jesus, you know,
I think that that's kind of a thing that, I mean, it's definitely a major problem. And we can talk about it a little bit at the end of this episode, that so many people, I think, view Hawaii as a theme park.
Yeah.
Like they kind of view it as a theme park, and it actually has had some really devastating, detrimental effects on the culture and the people who live in Hawaii. Have you ever been to Hawaii?
I haven't, but it's a place that I've always really wanted to go.
I mean, listen, I've been, when people say it is the most beautiful place that you will ever go, it's very, very true. Now, I think that I would be far, far more aware about my consumption in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Because I do think that that is just such a big issue. It's.
I think it's important that if you're going to go to Hawaii or any other country, I feel like it's always really important to give back to whatever country you're visiting. So like going to more local things and making sure that you are like supporting things like that and not just spending money at like the resorts and
right.
things like
that. And just being very aware of your consumption. Because I read something and I don't think that I wrote down the quote, and again, this is something that we will cover more in depth at the end of the episode, but the mentality that you are on vacation, everybody has a certain kind of vacation mentality, right? And oftentimes, quite necessarily, because we all work ourselves to death, when we're on vacation, we don't want to think about anything that's difficult.
Right.
We don't want to trouble ourselves with anything really except our comfort.
Yeah.
But the problem is when you're a place like Hawaii, which thrives on that kind of tourist culture and people are going there, that vacation culture.
Yeah.
What it means is that they are not being conscientious about how their consumption is affecting the people who live there.
Truly.
So it is just something to keep in mind. But
Should we get started?
I wanted to start with how Hawaii actually came to be, because I found this very interesting. And I actually covered Hawaii in school a lot.
Did you do like a state report and covered Hawaii?
No, I mean, we had a whole thing. I can find pictures, actually. It's probably deeply offensive now that I think about it. But we had a whole thing at my school. I went to a math and science school. So we covered...
You went to a math and science school?
I know. Fun fact about
11
me.
11 years of friendship and I'm just learning this now. Math and science?
Yeah, my elementary school...
Are you good at those things?
No.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, who are you?
I'm kind of good at science. I am not good at math at all.
Okay.
But I went to a math and science magnet school.
Okay.
I got in because my brother is really good at math and science. And at the time they had a policy that
if the siblings can just kind of join.
Siblings can just kind of go. So it was a better education than most other like public schools.
Right. You lucked out.
I did. I lucked out. Yeah. I mean, how much worse would I have been at math if I didn't go to that school? I'd probably not be able to do anything.
Christian's the really smart one, right?
Yeah.
Thanks, Christian.
Yeah. But we did a whole thing where we had a whole not a semester, but we had like a good chunk of time where we like covered a lot of stuff about Hawaii. I made like an entire kind of like science project about Hawaii. We went to an event where we all sang. I think we sang Aloha Oi. We had like tie-dye shirts and Lays, which...
Yeah. Well, honestly, I have a very similar... We did the same kind of thing for a school performance just in our gym, but I was the only person that knew how to do any of the dance just because I just think I was not afraid of the spotlight and no one else wanted to do it. It's the most awkward video ever because my whole class is singing some Hawaiian song behind me and I alone am hula-ing in front of the entire class singing, and it is so cringy and probably pretty culturally inappropriate.
Yeah, I will say the 90s were a real cringe time for being culturally inappropriate about Hawaii. Like, that's just the truth.
Or just being culturally inappropriate about anything. The only people that went as like Bob Marley for Halloween and stuff, like with the dread wig hat thing. I mean, yeah, it was a time.
It was a rough time. But I do want to talk about how Hawaii came to be.
Right.
So we're going to get a little science-y right now.
Okay.
The Earth's outer crust is made up of a series of tectonic plates that move over the surface of the planet, right? In areas where the plates come together, the ocean floor may crack open and volcanoes will form under the surface of the ocean. This is all stuff I feel like we covered in my math and science school. And when the volcanoes form, they create what's called a hot spot. And this is when molten lava or magma rises up from the volcanoes underneath the surface. About 40 million years ago, this is what happened in the middle of the Pacific plate. The plate moved over a hot spot, and as the lava hit the ocean water, it cooled, eventually making mountains in the ocean. As the mountains grew taller, a chain of islands were formed.
That is literally the coolest thing.
Yes, isn't it?
Ever.
I know. I wanted to cover that because I was like, that's so interesting.
I just wish, and like, sorry to keep talking about like myself when I was in school, I wish things were explained to me the way you just explained it to me when I was younger. Because what you just said, I'm picturing the whole thing. It's very fascinating. I feel like if I had heard that when I was 8 years old from a teacher, it would have gone in one ear and out the other. But that is so fascinating. Like, it's kind of like reverse Atlantis.
Yes, yeah, where there was nothing before, it literally came out, sprouted from underneath the
ocean. The mixture of like the hot and the cold is creating this land somehow. And now suddenly has created this huge plot of land for people to live on and create civilization.
And it's all covered in green and nuts. It's beautiful. I know. So then 2,000 years ago, Polynesians from the Marquesas Islands, about 2,000 miles away, which this was also wild to me, traveled by canoe. So 2,000 miles traveled by canoe and
on the Pacific Ocean. Mm-hmm. Oh God.
I think the Pacific. Yeah. And settled on Hawaii's Big Island, developing communities of fishermen and very skilled farmers.
Right.
So the people of Hawaii had their own distinct language, culture, and national identity, and they stuck mainly to themselves, isolated from much of the rest of the world. So that's,
yeah,
that's
I read that
I
for about 500 years, they were pretty isolated from the rest of the world and really were this self-contained, very like farm heavy culture.
Yeah, and fishermen.
Yeah,
and
they like lived among like on the things that they create. I mean, I guess we all did at that point because it was so long ago, but like they were very self-contained. They weren't worried about the goings on anywhere else.
I mean, yeah. I mean, to a greater extent, I think, than most other places because they were an island and kind of in the middle of nowhere.
They had less of an opportunity to go like travel. Like if you were in the United States, you could go see what is in that land over there. You would have to cross an ocean.
So they really didn't have a lot of outside influence. And so the reason why I wanted to start with that is not only because it's very cool scientifically, but also because it really stresses that this was a culture that, I mean, it had a very proud, rich, deep culture. Still
does.
That
was untouched.
Right. Yeah, it still does. But it makes the setting up of this story all the more devastating because we see what happens with just a tiny touch of outside influence, basically.
Right, exactly. So I have it that European settlers had started to come to the islands in like the 1770s, around there in the 1700s, and American immigration began shortly after. They're like, the Europeans found some great land, us being the United States, we're going to get on that, right?
Yeah. So in 1778, so the late 1700s, that was the first time that a European set foot on the Hawaiian Islands. And it's Captain James Cook, who we did cover in school. Wonder why.
Yeah.
And in true colonizer fashion, he claimed to discover, even though, again, there's a rich history of people
that's been there over 500 years.
Been there for a long time. And named the islands after the Earl of Sandwich. So the Sandwich Islands, right? And the various communities eventually unified into one kingdom under King Kamehameha, and unified might be the wrong word because it was more like he conquered the other rulers.
I was going to say kind of like forced all of the islands to kind of be run under this one king. So this monarchy was kind of started. And then I also read that like there was some sort of back and forth trying to figure out what this government was going to look like, because they were given this certain monarchy and then that was overthrown and then it kind of came back as another like monarchy, but this king Kamehameha was continued to be king throughout all of that as well. But there was some upheaval as to whether or not what this government was going to look like.
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting because I think the Hawaiians are known even now to be this very like welcoming, warm people, right? And throughout the 1700s and into the 1800s, Europeans and people from the United States started visiting Hawaii mainly on expeditions exploring the ocean, and Hawaiians were friendly. Like, they were very like welcoming to visitors. And one British explorer even gifted the Hawaiians a flag, the Hawaiian king, a British flag, and Hawaii adopted the British flag into their own flag. To this day, if you look at the Hawaiian flag, it has a Union Jack on it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Oh, you're right. Yeah.
They were just so, they were like, great. Like, we're welcome. Enjoy. Yeah. Hang out here. This is great. It's kind of chill. But of course, things couldn't stay chill.
No.
Dealing with colonists.
Yeah. You know? And I feel like another big thing that I was reading about was like the New England missionaries that wanted to, you know, bring their religion to another part of the world as well. Continuing to talk about religion on this podcast. But it's another great motivator, right? Like, it's another reason for, you know, these people to go and spread the good word and spread it further to these places where it doesn't need to reach.
Yes. As somebody who previously was a missionary, let me tell you, that is missionary gold.
When I wish we could have like talked more about that, because I've always thought that was the weirdest concept in the world, to go to another place to be like, I'm better than you and I know how to run your like little village better than you do, so I'm gonna build these things but then I'm gonna leave.
It's a very,
instead of helping my own country and the people that live there and all that kind of stuff.
It's a very colonist mindset.
Yeah.
If the listeners are interested, before I leave, and we want to cover missions,
we'll
and
just missionaries, cover missions.
we can, because there was a period of my life where I wanted to be a missionary. Like, it's
okay. I want to do the episode. I want to hear all these stories.
I wanted to make missions my life, so I completely understand. I understood.
Well, it makes you feel good because you feel like you're doing a good thing.
Not only do you feel like you're doing a good thing, you feel like it is your duty. Like it is your responsibility, and that missionaries are held up to this like higher echelon of Christianity. Like,
of course,
I remember, and I won't get into it too much because it's not what this episode's about, but like, I remember, and I can actually show you in my journals, we were made to listen to martyrs' prayers. So it was like Joan of Arc and like other martyrs and like the things that they would say about being happy to give up their life for Christ, and like that was, it was part of like, that's what you want to do.
And that
as a
Joan
missionary
of Arc story is bullshit, by the way. I'm doing her for a feminist fave someday, except for she maybe not be, she was kind of evil as well. Anyways, let's get back on topic.
Not the point, but okay. But like you said, King Kamehameha died in 1819, and the following year we saw the first Christian missionaries arrive to the islands, and this would be a big thing. And mostly these missionaries came from the United States.
Right.
They didn't come as much from Europe, and instead of passing through as many of the Europeans did, a lot of the Europeans were explorers who would stop and then they would leave. The missionaries decided to stay.
Yeah.
So they made their homes there. They had descendants who lived there, so kids and grandkids who were born in Hawaii, who were white people of European descent. But the influx of Europeans and Americans to the islands slowly began to devastate the native Hawaiian population with diseases. Hawaiians had numbered about 300,000 when Cook first arrived.
Yeah.
And by 1853, the native population was down to 70,000.
I mean, this is a story that we've heard time and time again, right? This is something that happened with the Native Americans in the United States as well. You know, when the European explorers came to the U.S., we gave them syphilis. You know what I mean? There was all of these horrible diseases that they had never been exposed to before, so their immune systems weren't built up for that to happen.
I mean, speaking of missionaries, it's why there's that very famous case. I think his name was John Chu, he was like a teenage missionary or in his early 20s, and he, because he's a missionary, and he was like, God is telling me that I need to proselytize to these people who don't have any contact with the outside world.
Right.
This was in the 2000s. And they were like, you are not legally allowed to go there because they, first of all, they've already basically, they've shown time and time again, they're not interested in being part of the outside world. And two, you are going to expose them to diseases that could decimate them because they have been so isolated for so long. Like you're not doing them any favors. Like,
you're not doing the help that you think you're going to be doing by going over there and talking to them. Yeah. So the native Hawaiians were essentially dying off when the white people came because of all of these diseases. But at the same time, the white people were like very impressed with their sugar plantations.
Well, yeah. I mean, what do colonizers love besides Jesus? And it is very often
sugar or booze.
Ooh, resources, any natural resources. If that's like we can get,
oil,
diamonds, bananas, sugar,
pineapple,
any of those things. And so, yes, I mean, this land was very rich. It was undeveloped. So they immediately went in, started, you know, grabby little raccoon paws.
Right.
Just snatching up land.
Well, and the Hawaiians have been doing this for so long and they've been doing it so well that they were kind of like, we want a piece of the pie too, a little bit, you know? So sugar, to me, kind of seems like what started this whole thing off. They were like, this is a resource that is incredibly wanted and valuable all over the world, and this could potentially make us a lot of money.
Yeah,
and they saw in, like, an incentive through that.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially in the United States, because they were able to export sugar tariff-free from Hawaii. So it was very, very valuable. And of course, you know, they're missionaries, but they still want to make their money. And so they were driven a lot by that. And then, of course, just because this is the colonialist mindset, they were like, well, we can do your government better than you're doing your government. And so
exactly.
They started chipping away at native culture and governmental practices. And by the late 1800s, American colonialists controlled Hawaii's sugar-based economy, amassing a huge amount of Hawaii's wealth. So they easily outmatched native Hawaiians in terms of monetary wealth, like economic power.
And part of this was the fault of the king at the time named David Kakakaua. I'm so sorry if I pronounce some of these names wrong. I've really done my best to write them phonetically. He was named king in 1874, and he signed a trade reciprocity treaty with the U.S. in 1885, making it possible for Hawaiian sugar to be sold to the U.S. market tariff-free. In 1887, the treaty was renewed, and suddenly hordes of white people descended upon the Hawaiian islands, including white businessmen, landowners, and missionaries, like we were talking about, moving onto the island. And King David really promoted Hawaii's, you know, like culture and traditions, kind of like they are today, as almost like a way to lure in more people to be coming to the land. And it worked too well. Suddenly, the landholding system changed and many aspects of the original culture was prohibited, including the teaching of Hawaiian language and performance of the native hula dance. So to me, it kind of sounds like King David was ready to welcome people with open arms and be like, the more the merrier. Let's spread this around. We'll help you. You help us. That kind of thing. But then almost with his open arms, started to cause more trouble.
I think he was very welcoming and very trusting. If I have it right, I think that he is actually the one who put the Union Jack on the flag.
Probably. It sounds like something he would do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, listen.
He was like, I love white people.
He seemed like a very nice man. Like,
I'm
truly,
sure. But I think he was a little bit idealistic is what I take from him. I think that he really wanted to help Hawaii, and he saw that, you know, they could make money by teaming up with these Americans, and it ended up just really backfiring on Hawaii's culture.
I agree. I do think, though, you know, I think he was very much strong-armed into giving up a lot of the power. So many of the missionaries' descendants formed a fully armed, all-white militia called the Honolulu Rifles.
Yeah.
And it was in 1887, in order to counter any sort of native resistance, the militia demanded that the king, King Kalakua.
I call him King David in my notes.
I always try to remember that. I'm just like, okay, you say every vowel. So it's like a Kalaakua. So they demanded of him that he dismiss his cabinet.
Right.
And presented a list of demands to him, including that a new constitution must be written.
Right. And they called this one the Bayonet Constitution because he was put under duress to sign it.
It was called that later on because of that. They didn't call it that, but because he was strong-armed. I mean, because initially he tried to resist, but the militiamen took control of an Australian ship filled with guns and using these weapons threatened the king. He requested aid from the British, French, Portuguese, and Japanese. He was like, he wanted to fight them, but all of them refused to step in, suggesting that he just comply. They were like, just comply to the demands. So less than a week later, a new constitution was drafted by a group of lawyers who were all members of the Hawaiian League, which was a group of white men who all explicitly wanted the end of the kingdom and to see its annexation to the United States.
Exactly. And this is when we're going to start seeing more and more work for Hawaii to become a U.S. territory after this point as well.
Right. Yeah. So the colonists were eager to topple Hawaii's government and seize control.
Right.
And with the death of Kalaakua, which happened in 1891, his sister, Queen Liliuokalani.
I think it's Liliuokalani.
Liliuokalani. Yes. Gosh, my mouth is like mush right
now. I've also been calling her Queen Lily in my notes because writing the whole thing out every time is just a lot for these little hands.
So
she was the first. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. She was the first and only queen of Hawaii.
You know, I knew she, you know why I knew that she was the first, which I guess would mean that she would be the only.
Yeah.
Is because I used to read those. Did you ever read Dear America books?
Are you kidding me? Those were my favorite books growing up.
I read all of them. And
do you remember the Irish immigrant one where they get scalped?
I'm certain I read it. I have literally, my mom has a bunch of them up in the attic of her house still. And then I also, they had a princess series.
Yes.
And I loved those ones. And they had one for Liliuokalani.
So I just recognize, like when I saw pictures of her, I was like, I've seen her. I wonder if she's on money or if like, I was like wondering why that face is so recognizable to me.
She's a huge cultural figure for them even now.
Well, she was a fucking badass.
Yes, like, she's amazing.
She was really, really rad. So she became queen and she believed that the root problem for Hawaii was foreign influence. So she was very much not of the same mind as her brother, even though her brother did learn down the line.
But she did fiercely love her brother and she even said and defended him to the Hawaiian people when he signed that constitution. She told them, like, he did this under duress. He would not have sold you out if he didn't have to.
Well, a lot of similar situations would end up happening with her as well. You know, there's only so much you can do when you are being overpowered, you know. But I think she is a total badass. I am a big fan. I started reading her Wikipedia page just because I was like, I want to know more about you.
There's a great, like, little 5-minute TED talk type thing about this subject, but it focuses very strongly on her. And she is very, very cool.
She's so cool. So shortly after she took the throne, she signed a new constitution to get rid of the Bayonet Constitution, which would restore her power and Hawaiian rights. So when the Bayonet Constitution was written, it really did strip King David of a lot of his abilities as king.
Yeah.
And like I mentioned, a lot of the rights for Native Hawaiians as far as like how they were able to express their culture with their language, their dance, so on and so forth. So she really did what she could to be able to bring that back. But there's a lot of militia groups, a lot of them. And there was another group called the Committee of Safety, which was another group comprised of white businessmen and politicians. They countered the Queen's Constitution. And of course, their interest was in sugar production and worried that the Constitution would establish tariffs to return
capitalism.
To return to sugar imports, endangering their progress. So that was their main reason for why they were not cool with the Queen starting this new Constitution. Right.
There was also a group called the Missionary Party. So there's like several different groups. And though the sugar missionaries were powerful economically, all of these militia groups, the vast majority of which were white people who were born in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Though they were very powerful economically and had an arsenal of weapons at their disposal, they were still in the minority in terms of, like, you know, the Native Hawaiians outnumbered them.
Right.
And so overthrowing the government would have been difficult on their own. But luckily for them, in 1893, the American ambassador of Hawaii, John L. Stevens, helped coordinate the arrival of an American military ship and troops to arrive on the shores of the island of Oahu. Now, of Oahu. So up until this point, even though it can feel very internal, external, because it's like natives versus white people.
Yeah.
Even though it feels like it's an internal versus external conflict, it really wasn't. The conflict was really very internal at this point. You're talking about white militiamen, mostly who were born in Hawaii.
Right. And the people that, and even the natives of Hawaii, like they were born in amongst these people already. Right. You know what I mean? It's not like they had just come. This was already their way of life. They, you know, the native Hawaiians or the non-white people coexisted with the white people for a long period of time at this point.
Yeah. I mean, and even though the white Hawaiians, we'll call them, like the white people who were born in Hawaii, they were very loyal to their European ancestors and definitely had a colonialist mindset.
Well, because that's, I'm sure, how they were raised and how the story was told to them.
They would still call themselves Hawaiian because they were born there. Now, you know, obviously they weren't native Hawaiians. But the second that ship arrived from the United States to provide military backup to these white militiamen, it transitioned from being an internal conflict to a coup.
Yeah.
And it was a military coup that was sponsored and backed by a foreign power, which is a big no-no. Like, even now, it's like you don't back another country. Like, you don't do this kind of, like, insurgence to a sovereign nation in this way. You know? So it was...
Yeah. It wasn't playing by any sort of rules, definitely.
We weren't taught that.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. It's like, well, and that's also, like, kind of smart. Because, in a way, like, that is another element of surprise. To be able to, like, get what you want. Because you're not doing it the way the game is supposed to be played.
Yeah, I definitely don't think that Queen Liliuokalani thought that this was going to happen.
No.
You know, I don't think that she expected that this
I definitely
kind of
don't
force...
think that the amount of military force that would be behind all of this. I think that the infighting, I'm sure she was prepared for.
Oh, definitely.
But
the
fact that this would become such a major conflict politically and economically, I don't think that anyone could foresee that coming.
Yeah, I don't think that she figured that she was going to have to cede her country or her nation up to another country. Like, I don't think that she foresaw that at all.
I mean, essentially after this, Hawaii was proclaimed the Committee of Safety as the provisional government of Hawaii.
Right. And it was set up under the name of a man named Sanford Dole. Very interesting. Might sound familiar.
Is it Dole or Doyle?
It's Dole.
So in one article, it was Doyle. So I kept writing Doyle everywhere unless I read it wrong. So I have Doyle in my notes. I apologize if I say Doyle, but it's okay. Dole. It's like the Dole guy,
The Dole guy. Well, he's from that family. So that sound familiar to you. I probably have like Dole pineapple juice in my fridge
right
now.
It's his brother.
Yeah,
it was his brother that started the whole pineapple situation. I've got that in the end of my notes. We can talk about that then. But yeah, this fucking Dole guy came and was like, I'm going to be the governor because I say so.
Right. And he was one of the people who pushed for the bayonet constitution. He'd been pushing for this for a long time to set himself up or someone else of European or American descent up to take over Hawaii.
Definitely.
So before we get into everything that happens from here on out, should we take a quick break?
I mean, I guess we have to.
I think probably, yeah. Okay.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
And we're back. All right.
All right. So I also want to mention that it was during this time. So I had never heard of President Benjamin Harrison. Have you ever heard of President Benjamin Harrison?
I thought we only had one Harrison. I thought that was William Henry Harrison.
Well, this was the 23rd president of the United States. I had never heard of this man.
Flyover presidents. We don't remember them.
Exactly. Yeah. This guy was Benjamin Harrison. He was a real dick. He signed a treaty of annexation with the new government of Hawaii. So this was kind of the first time that we saw any sort of like government motion to head toward annexation. But luckily, after Benjamin Harrison, my new boyfriend, President Grover Cleveland, came into office. Now, I don't know that much about him, but he comes off looking real good in this story for the most part.
You know, I think we got our notes from different places because I was still kind of like,
really?
about Mr. Grover.
Okay, because what I read was that he had a very different mindset than past presidents had, because he disagreed with annexation. He was anti-imperialist and he believed that Americans had acted shamefully in Hawaii.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think that there was a lot, everything that I read or watched did say that there was a lot of back and forth as to what to do. So it did go on. I mean, there's a reason why Hawaii didn't become a state until the 50s.
Right.
Even, you know, given when all of this stuff started.
Yeah.
There's a reason why there was so much like back and forth that happened in Washington, D.C.
It does seem that at least while Grover Cleveland was president, he was able to push aside a lot of those bills that were coming through and making sure they weren't reaching the Senate and things like that. He also, when he discovered that the Queen was overthrown illegally, he had the American flag removed from Hawaiian government buildings as well.
Yes.
So in that case,
it is nice. However, you know, the people of Hawaii were trying to protest this takeover peacefully. They have continued, and we'll talk about it at the end of this episode, that their form of protest has always been incredibly peaceful. And yeah, it was even then. They would wear hats that read Aloha Anai, which meant love of the nation. I hope I'm saying that correctly. And signing petitions condemning what was happening. And
oh, their petition signing was like almost iconic.
Everyone
truly
signed the petition.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm going to say this really quick because I really thought this was amazing. So they ran this massive petition drive leading 21,269 signatures from Native Hawaiians. So at the time, that was more than half of the 39,000 yes, natives and mixed blood persons reported by the Hawaii census that year. So it was like,
it was huge.
It was huge.
Yeah.
The way that they were able to organize and be very successful in their protests is really, really something to be astonished by, especially when you're going up against people that tend to choose violence first, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they really did believe in the power of the people and the power of the people's love for their country.
And like, they really believed that if the United States knew how much they didn't want this,
right,
that they would listen. And it's like, oh, you sweet, sweet, innocent children.
I know. So Sanford Dole traveled to the United States and petitioned the government saying that the U.S. should take Hawaii for themselves. But a group of Native Hawaiians traveled saying that they opposed the overthrow of the Queen. And she also wrote a letter to the House of Representatives demanding that she be reinstated as rightful ruler.
Yeah,
she
stating also, that I was taken away from my throne illegally.
Right.
Like really making that a point to be like, this was not legal.
Yes. Yeah. She hired a lawyer. So she hired a lawyer to deliver a letter to Grover Cleveland.
Right.
So the Cleveland administration commissioned someone to investigate the overthrow. So he interviewed those involved in the coup, and he wrote in what was called the Blount Report, because his name was James Henderson Blount. He wrote that based on his findings, he concluded that the overthrow of the Queen was illegal.
Yeah.
And that Stevens and American military troops had acted inappropriately in support of those who carried the overthrow. So that's when Grover Cleveland was like, yes, I believe that to be true, which is great. 1 point for him.
Yes.
However, on November 16th, Cleveland sent his minister, Albert S. Willis, to propose a return of the throne to Queen Lili Aukalani if she granted amnesty to everyone responsible. So he was like, I will, you know, we'll put you, we'll reinstate you, but you have to grant amnesty to all these people who violently overthrew your, you know, monarchy.
He definitely seems like somebody that isn't willing to get his hands dirty, because there was another time where he was unwilling to get involved because he didn't want to start a battle with something in Hawaii.
He wanted to be peaceful.
He wanted to keep things peaceful. While I think that that is a great thing and we should always fight for that, he comes off looking like a bit of a pushover.
Right. Well, and the thing is, I actually completely understand. If you can resolve a conflict peacefully, you should.
Right.
So I agree with him on that. However, Queen Lili Aukalani, her response was that she's like, I'm the Queen of Hawaii. They did this in Hawaii. Hawaiian law says that it calls for property confiscation and the death penalty for treason. She's
fuck
like,
yeah.
This is our law. They did this on our land, and you shouldn't get to decide what I do with the people who threw a coup on my land.
100%.
So she was like, no. She said that only her cabinet ministers could put aside the law in favor of amnesty. So she didn't even say, I am going to administer the death penalty. She said, my cabinet members who were already in place, they get to decide what we do here, whether or not we administer the death penalty or not. But this is Hawaiian law. So this didn't sit well with Grover Cleveland. He was like, actually, I'm going to withdraw, my support of putting you back on the throne.
Right.
And so eventually she was like, well, fine, I'll reverse my position regarding amnesty. But at that point, Grover Cleveland was like, no, the offer is no longer on the table. So that's why I'm like, about Grover Cleveland. Because I'm like, look, I am all for peaceful resolution. I think that that's the best way to go. However, it's her country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you're going to come in and tell her, like, put stipulations on.
Nobody does that to Queen Lili Aukalani.
Yeah. It was just really not. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, things definitely pushed further toward making Hawaii a U.S. territory when the Spanish-American War was looming, because there was an argument that Hawaii would be strategically valuable as a mid-Pacific fueling station and naval installation, bringing up the subject of annexation once again. So the U.S. wanted to use Hawaii for their military operations during the war, and that made the area even more enticing to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in 1895, I don't remember when the Spanish-American War was. I don't remember if it fell before or after this. But in 1895, there was a rebellion that took place because things had started to devolve even further. Like in 1894, the year before that, there was a provision that put in place saying that Native Hawaiians couldn't vote or hold government office without signing an oath of allegiance. And a lot of Native Hawaiians weren't willing to do that. So they just got pushed out of all of these jobs. And so things were getting really out of hand. And in 1895, there was a rebellion that took place in an attempt to restore Queen Lili Aukalani to power.
Yeah.
There was hundreds of people. They were like, we're going to take this back, basically. It was a failure, and it did ultimately lead to the arrest of hundreds of the participants and other sympathizers of the monarchy. And Lili Aukalani was also arrested and imprisoned in an upstairs bedroom at the palace. So the palace had also been kind of taken over and was now being used as a government building. This was the home of the monarchy.
Right.
So she was being imprisoned in an upstairs bedroom at the palace.
It is very like Disney princess of them to do that.
Right. So they found firearms in her home and imprisoned her. During her imprisonment, I love her. During her imprisonment, she composed songs expressing her love for her people, one of which was Aloha Oi, which I said, you know, we learned in elementary school.
Yeah.
Which is called Farewell to Thee. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful song.
It is a gorgeous song.
And began making a patchwork quilt that told the story of her life. Though she was not allowed news of the outside world, her supporters often brought her flowers carefully wrapped in newspapers so she could stay aware of what was going on outside.
So they'd smart.
Present her flowers, and inside there would be newspapers wrapped around the flowers so that she could, you know.
I love that.
Yes. But during her imprisonment, she actually ended up abdicating the throne in return for the release and the commutation of the death sentences of the people who had rebelled for her. So all these
Which
people,
makes sense. She wanted to save the people's lives that were trying to help her. Yes. I think that that is the most queenly thing to do, to look out for your people rather than your own power.
Yeah. I mean, and in she signed the document of abdication, and then she wrote, quote, "For myself, I would have chosen death rather than to have signed it. But it was represented to me that by my signing this paper, all of the persons who had been arrested, all my people now in trouble by reason of their love and loyalty towards me, would be immediately released. Think of my position, sick, a lone woman in prison, scarcely knowing who was my friend or who listened to my words only to betray me, without legal advice or friendly counsel, and the stream of blood ready to flow unless I stayed my pen." So she's like, I had to sign this letter of abdication because if I didn't, I was afraid that for more violence and for everybody I loved and who was on my
exactly.
side to be murdered.
And basically. Though that would be an incredibly difficult decision, she's doing exactly what a leader should do. And that is to take into the minds of the people that she is supposed to be caring for ahead of your own power and your own job title, essentially.
Yeah. And it should be said that there was a lot of men. So Grover Cleveland did kind of stay things moving further.
Yeah.
But then after that, the next president and his cabinet, of which included Theodore Roosevelt, were like, nope, actually, we want to grab that land for ourselves.
Yeah. Good old William McKinley was just ready and waiting. As soon as he took office in March of 1897, he was pro annexation and moved fast to claim Hawaii. Now that Cleveland was gone, he's like, mom's away, let's go out to play.
Yeah, and as soon as they landed on shore, they went right back up to the palace and put the American flag right back up there.
Yep.
And it was now officially a possession of the United States. We had successfully stolen their land. I almost feel like annexation is too kind
of
a word.
Too nice of a word.
Yeah.
The stealing of Hawaii, yes. Yeah, so now it was officially the U.S. territory of Hawaii after this.
Yeah, and it was not long before the United States started. I mean, basically, the United States had already been, but really in full throttle, started dismantling their way of life. The Hawaiian language was officially banned, and all government work or business work was required by law to be conducted in English. So if you were at a government job, or, you know, just basically working almost anywhere that had any oversight,
right,
you had to speak English. Of course, it had been limited in schools up until now. It was officially fully banned in any kind of like public school capacity.
Yeah.
The U.S. also began developing land on sites sacred to the Native Hawaiians, and the history that was being taught in schools made it appear as though the Native Hawaiians were happy to welcome the United States in without a fight.
Well, right. I think that that's very similar as when we talk about, you know, the Native Americans in the mainland. It's like, look at how we helped them.
Oh,
we taught them these things. They
taught us these things.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It was this mutual loving kind of thing.
Right. And as time went on, it became harder and harder to know what the truth was, because much of the real history was documented in the Hawaiian language, and it became more and more inaccessible as time went on. So the only history that even Native Hawaiians or people of Native Hawaiian
was descent the English history.
Was English history.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, and the other thing that really sucks is that in the U.S., the Hawaii had very little power anywhere in the U.S. government. They had one non-voting representative in the House, and that was all. And so from my understanding in the reading, that there were a lot of Hawaiians at this point that almost preferred statehood because they believed that that would help them gain the same rights, yes, and the same voting power as the mainland, as the rest, yeah, of the 48 states, yes, at the time.
I see that argument a lot because at this point, Hawaii is a territory, not a state. And
it seems like a very in-between sort of purgatory type situation.
It's because, like Puerto Rico now.
Yeah, like, mm-hmm, they don't have autonomy to run their own government, but they don't have the power to make any decisions for their government at the same time.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people who will argue, well, the Hawaiian people voted to become a state. They wanted to become a state. I know that that's very much how it was framed to me. And it's like, okay, but they wanted to under these specific circumstances that they didn't ask to be in. Like, they didn't want to
exactly
be in these
the
circumstances.
Point.
Yeah,
exactly. It's not like they suddenly changed their mind and were like, no, we really want to be a state now. Please, please, please make it official. Yeah. Like, it wasn't. It was just because they were realizing the fact that, like, this territory status is worse. It's worse for us. We're not getting anything, right, that we want.
Yeah.
And so the only way at that point to make it better was to fight to be part of the 50, right, or 48 looked, states at the time.
They looked at the options and they said, well, in our current position, this is the best move. Like, it wasn't, I don't think, something that they were like, oh, super stoked that the United States came here and stole our land and culture.
Yeah, like, but they couldn't even elect their own governor or judges. That was all decided for them. And I can imagine that that would be incredibly frustrating, especially now, you know, seeing how the other states are run and handled. It's like, well, we want to have a say in who's going to be running our state as well and not just have you appoint somebody.
Right, absolutely. Especially since Hawaii's culture, I mean, once surfer culture started really kicking in the 60s, you saw a lot more talk about, like, Hawaii and Hawaiian tourism. But even previous to this, like in like the 30s and 40s, there was still a lot of tourism to Hawaii. So they're very much being closely, they're being able to see all of this stuff very much firsthand of, like, the American experience.
Yeah,
and
it's like they're like almost living the American experience, but they're not at the same time.
Yeah.
And I can understand why it would be enticing for them to just want to be a part of what everyone else is getting at that point.
Yeah, I totally understand it as
I'm
well.
I'm sure they would rather have, you know what I mean? But also at this point, the people who are living in Hawaii do not remember before either. You know what, yes, I mean? This has been happening for so long that I can understand that this next generation of Hawaiians would want that.
Right. And again, there's a certain amount of, I don't want to diminish anything by saying brainwashing, but it is a re-education. That's really what it was.
Well, like, over a very long period of time, yeah, too. And that is a generational reteaching of history,
yeah,
and taking away of culture. So that by the time these people are being born, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, they don't have the same experiences as their ancestors,
yeah,
do. And they have a different perspective about what is needed for their, right, land to go forward.
All of that to say that in 1959, Hawaii did become America's 50th state. As for Queen Liliuokalani, she spent the rest of her life petitioning for the restoration of her lands, native Hawaiian rights, and national liberation until her death in 1917.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, it should be said, the Dole family's empire grew and prospered into one of the most recognizable global corporations of all time.
Yeah, so James Dole, I almost said Doyle again, like I mentioned, he was the cousin of Sanford, and he established and dominated the pineapple industry. Pineapple production went from 2,000 cases in 1903 to 12,808,000 cases in 1931, all thanks to James Dole.
Yeah, and I want to say that they also had a hand in, like, Dole is also a big producer of bananas.
Yeah.
And I want to say that they had a hand in the Banana Republic, which is a whole other historical thing that we don't need to get
not
into
the
right
clothing
now.
Clothing line, right?
No.
Like, really? Like,
the Banana Republic was an actual, like, political thing that happened to do with banana production and
makes
colonialism
sense to me
in another place. And I do think that Dole had hands in that as well, which is, man, what a bummer, because I've definitely, like I said, I probably have a Dole product in this house right now.
Who doesn't love Dole Whip at Disneyland?
Yeah, I mean, and they have like, I think there's also lots of canned vegetables. Like, I think you can get like Dole green beans. Like,
you can get
canned.
Dole like fruit in the little cups,
fruit cups.
And
actually,
stuff.
We probably have those in the fridge. You know, so
man, I haven't had a fruit cup in a minute.
Me neither, but Anthony really likes them. So
is it like the one with like the peaches
in
and
the
all,
juice,
the little
and,
mix,
and you like pull the top off?
Yeah. It's, like, oh, I used to always plastic. Drain the juice. First, and then I was obsessed with those as a kid.
What a time.
Thanks, but no thanks, Dole.
But yeah, I mean, so you can see what happened here. It's like you see what happened to Queen Liliuokalani in juxtaposition with what happened with the Dole family,
right?
Where they became these really, it's like a $1 billion industry or more.
Yeah, definitely. And you were mentioning this earlier about how more and more sacred land was being taken over and bought by white landowners and things like that. Well, obviously that continued to happen once, you know, statehood was acquired by Hawaii. And eventually Hawaiians demanded the U.S. government to set aside land for them to return to their customary farming lifestyle. And in 1921, the government provided land with the Hawaiian Home Program, but it was poorly managed and only benefited a small number of Hawaiians. And that was the only time that there was ever any sort of effort to be able to give them some of their land back. Although they did get an apology from Mr. Bill Clinton, quote unquote apology. The contents of this have been incredibly criticized. The wording of this has been very criticized, but this is what it is. On November 23rd, 1993, a joint apology resolution was signed by President Clinton. This resolution apologized, quote, to Native Hawaiians on behalf of the people of the United States for the overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii on January 17th, 1893, and the deprivation of the rights of Native Hawaiians to self-determination.
I mean,
thanks for the apology.
There's always this thing for me that I'm like, I am glad that an apology was issued, because I do think that those things on a very public scale are important.
Right.
However, it does just end up feeling like, okay, empty words, damage has been done for like a long time now.
And I almost think that that's part of the problem. I feel like it's been so long that these people's requests have been ignored, that it probably would be pretty difficult to, at this point, try to regain some of that cultured lifestyle back by the time 1993 rolled around.
Yeah, I mean, and to the credit of the Native Hawaiians, there were people who had resistance, Native resistance, from the beginning and did not ever give up their culture or the knowledge of their culture and made sure to maintain that. And now in Hawaii, there are schools that do full immersion in the Hawaiian language.
Good.
Because they were able to preserve that.
Well, those are things that I think can be done. Like if the U.S. government is not able to like give you your land back or give you your jobs back, the fact that the people were able to take it into their own hands and say it's our responsibility to bring this culture back to our people, I think that that is just as powerful in its own right.
Right. I mean, I absolutely agree. And they have definitely been able to hold on to a lot of cultural practices. And you can, and it's so beautiful to see, you know, the hula, the language, there's so much of it that they have been able to hold on to. But I think another reason why that apology rings so false is because the United States does continue to exploit the land and culture of the Hawaiian people.
Yeah.
They do continue to protest those who attempt to develop on their sacred land, which has not stopped. In 2020, Native Hawaiians gathered to protest the construction of a large new telescope on Mauna Kea, which is considered sacred ground. That same year, they fought the construction of wind turbines in Oahu that protesters said would have adverse long-term health effects. More than 160 people were arrested at that protest. Though tourism is a big part of Hawaii's economy, many of the locals barely make enough to get by. Those who work in tourism especially say that they often work more than one job and barely make ends meet, while the resorts are often run by non-Hawaiians.
Yeah.
This is a big thing, and I didn't dig deep into this, but I know I've talked about this many times, very just surface level, that Disney is a huge perpetrator of this. And like they release films like Moana, which are beautiful and definitely speak to the Hawaiian culture in a real way, which is lovely to see. And I'm glad that they're exposing that culture to young audiences.
Right.
However, they are actively, their resorts in Hawaii are actively devastating the landscape there. And
it's almost like another like public promotion to go to Hawaii thing. And things like that. Remember like when Finding Dory came out, those like blue fish, like everyone was buying them out and like not treating them well and not like realizing that like you actually have to like there's fish, work to be put into this type fish of fish and things
so
like that.
So much work. They really do. Like fish requires so much work. And
remember Mabel?
I do. That's how I know. My fish Mabel. It was so hard. But truly like there's a lot to be said about that, that like the tourism industry in Hawaii is a huge industry, and it is what keeps their economy going.
Right. So however, they need it so they in a big way.
In a big way. However, we're not compensating the workers well.
No.
So unfortunately, there's a big poverty problem for Native Hawaiians in Hawaii, because it is in large part because of tourism, the most expensive state to live in.
Right.
Not only because of tourism, but also because of the cost of shipping things in and out from Hawaii, because it is further away
it's
than
very isolated
continental United States. You can't just drive things there. So if you want to visit Hawaii, do so in a way that causes less harm. There is something called, Detours, which is a decolonial guide to Hawaii. So it is, they are tours that are given to groups of people who want to learn about Hawaii from the perspective of a local Hawaiians.
I love that.
Which is something that I would be far more interested in doing if I were to go back to Hawaii.
Yeah.
They include deep history on the ways military life is hidden across the land. When I went to Hawaii last time, I went actually on a ROTC. I've lived many lives. I went on an ROTC trip and I actually stayed on a Marine base.
That's so cool.
I mean, it's cool, but it is also true that it's like there's
it's
so
sad
much
at the same time,
American military presence all over Hawaii. So the typical tour guests do get to see the Aiolani Palace, which is the palace that the Hawaiian royal family lived in, that then got turned into basically a government building.
Right.
And then they are also taken through Chinatown and some of the old neighborhoods where new immigrants to Hawaii would traditionally settle and things like that.
Right.
So it is just a less commercialized, less touristy way of viewing Hawaii. So it might be something to look into if you are considering going to Hawaii, because I do, it's such a beautiful place, but I do urge you, if you are going to contribute to the tourist population in Hawaii, to do so very, very mindfully.
I mean, I think that should go for when you're visiting any other country. I think that you should have a responsibility to do things as ethically as possible in your life, and that includes your vacationing. Not that you want to be thinking about that when you're on vacation, but maybe think about it before you leave on your vacation and set up your itinerary in a certain way. I'm very appreciative that my parents were pretty good at that for the most part. Like if we went to Mexico a lot, they would take us to the ruins and things like that and not just stay inside our little like all-inclusive resort the whole time. And I just think that if you're going to travel, part of that is the education that you get along with it. So I think that any of those resources are always the way to go when traveling in general.
Yeah, definitely. So. Definitely.
Oh, well, this was quite an education for me and definitely piqued my interest on a lot more people and subjects as well, which I'm always appreciative of.
Yeah.
New obsessions are always my favorite.
And I will say this was such a big topic. There's definitely stuff we missed or didn't cover or could have covered more in depth.
Like, yeah, there are so many specific things that went on back and forth during those many years.
People, and it was a lot. And so we covered the highlights. I hope we did an okay job.
People, if we have listeners from Hawaii, please write in. I would love, do we have Hawaiian listeners?
I'm sure.
That would be really cool. If we missed anything, if you want to add anything, if you have your own personal stories that you want to add, anything like that, we would really, really love to hear it. So if you have any topic ideas for the future, if you want to write into us, you can email us at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com or DM us on our Instagram at @angryneighborhoodfeminist. If you want to check out our merch, there is a link in the show notes. We have a Facebook business and group page. You can rate and review us on the business page and chat with your fellow listeners on the group page. And last but certainly not least, if you haven't done so already, please hop on over to your Apple Podcast app, leave us a 5-star review and a quick sentence about why you enjoy the show. It means so much to us. All right, so I'll be happy today. With all of that being said, we encourage you
to rage on.
Bye. She did it.
I got it this time.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.